Grandma Sophie Vazekis. This is the number 0172. The Stuff File with Peter Anthony Holder. And it's coming to you right now.
The following program is brought to you in living color.
Now, it's time for an eclectic mix of interviews and some of the oddest news stories you'll ever hear. It's the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder.
Hey there, hi there, ho there! Peter Anthony Holder here with you, and yes, this is indeed another edition of the Stuff File program, number 0172. And coming up on this edition of the Stuff File program, you'll meet actress Dawn Wells, best known as Mary Ann from Gilligan's Island. Recently, a tabloid spread hurtful lies about her. Does that bother her?
You know, it really hurts. I mean, it breaks your heart. I now can kind of separate myself from it because it's happened a couple of times, and I don't know. I guess the world focuses on gossip. There's a lot more people doing a lot worse things that they spend time with, Lindsay Lohan and all that. But I have spent a lot of my career kind of upholding the image of Mary Ann, and I think maybe there's something about trying to bring down the good girl. I don't know. It hurts for a while, but it's just laughable.
Dr. Stephen Weiss is the author of Second Chance, which deals with his time during World War II in the military and the battle fatigue he suffered. Why did he wait so long to write the book?
I had to grow into it. I had to consider the issues, consider the experiences, and then to have some kind of understanding of why I went through it and how did I succeed and fail with regard to the experience.
David Kahn is an investigator and expert on cult behavior. His book is The Specific Density of Scientists and Their Secret Fears. What is the difference between cults and cult mentality?
One of the major signs of a cult mentality is the inability to see the obvious, and that happens all over the place. The difference between a cult mentality and cults in themselves is simply organizational. It stems from some cult leader organizing and premising certain precepts according to his own cultic views.
And there's lots and lots and lots of stuff, and of course, an idiot of the day. The guest later, the person who told you this was show number 0172, was little Sophie Vazekis, the priceless daughter of Andrew Vazekis, the night sky guy, and his lovely bride, Zoe Chi. Thank you very much, Sophie, for doing the guest slate on this edition of the Stuff File program, and thank you very much, Andrew and Zoe, for letting Sophie do the opening slate on this edition of the Stuff File program, a program that's also heard on Stitcher Smart Radio, the smarter way to listen to radio. Let's get right to the stuff, shall we? Russians can face the Mayan apocalypse fully prepared thanks to a kit being sold that includes a bottle of vodka and, as a nod to pessimists, some rope. For those who think they might have a chance of surviving whatever comes on December 21st, the kit contains other staples, a packet of buckwheat, a can of fish, candles, matches, notepad, pencil, heart and other medication, and soap. It also has a helpful tutorial on post-apocalypse board games to pass the time after the world as we know it comes to an end. The kits, produced by a local bridal party operator as a joke gift, cost 890 rubles, that's about 27 bucks. Funny or not, the sale of more than 1,000 of the kits prompted local officials to put the kibosh on the operation because special permits are needed to sell alcohol or medication. The kits are in response to the supposed cataclysm to come at the end of the 5,000-year Mayan calendar, which lists December 21st as its final date. Yeah, well, you know, I already bought my 2013 desk blotter calendar. Yeah, that's right. I'm a renegade, a bad boy. I spit in the face of the Mayans. I live on the edge. Anyway, what's in a name? Wait, and I'll tell you. Here's a quote. We said to each other, wouldn't it be funny if we had the baby on Thanksgiving? That's what a proud father said, and sure enough, the baby boy was born on Thanksgiving. We're super excited, the 33-year-old man from Malden, Massachusetts said. The turkey is still in the refrigerator. We'll do it when we get back, I guess. The 8-pound, 4-ounce boy is healthy, but unnamed. His father's name, by the way, Ryan Gobble. Yes. A turkey was born to the Gobble family, or at least a baby, rather, was born to the Gobble family on Turkey Day. That's what I was trying to say. The turkey may still be in the fridge, but you know, the bun's now out of the oven. Well, among the federally funded projects highlighted in the 2012 Waste Book of U.S. Senator Tom Coburn were the $325,000 grant to develop a robo-squirrel, that's to help study the somehow confusing interaction between squirrels and rattlesnakes. I don't know, I'm not confused, but anyway. And a $700,000 grant by the National Science Foundation of a New York theater company to create a musical about climate change and biodiversity, which actually opened this year in Kansas City and included, among other concepts, according to one critic, flying monkey poop. Abuses of the food stamp program were also detailed, such as one exotic dancer who, while earning $85,000, drew food stamps in an amount roughly equivalent to the sum she spent on cosmetic enhancements. Of course, all of this waste does bring the U.S. one step closer to that fiscal cliff, doesn't it? Yes. And finally, in this section of Stuff File News, before we get to our first guest, you know, it's amazing what will pass for art these days. I have a couple of items that exemplify this. First, here's a quote. "I wanted to create a self-portrait that was completely stripped of visual prejudice." That was Polish-born New York artist Martinka Woryzniak, and she has chosen the medium of smell for her gallery showing in a New York City gallery. Now, for starters, she scientifically extracted her hair oils, armpit perspiration, and tears to protest humans cloaking themselves in deodorant soaps and laundry powders, and blasted visitors with whiffs of it as they entered the gallery. Yeah. And the other one is even more out there. The Tate Liverpool Museum in England was host on October 19th to artist Carrie Morrison's Birdsheet Music Project, in which she laid down a giant blank music score sheet under a tree and waited for birds to make deposits on it, which she took to represent notes that composer Jan Herring plans to play straight as the sound of blackbirds. You know, when someone says that music sounds like crap, that might actually be a compliment and a statement of fact. I'm just saying. Anyway, let's get to our first guest here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, shall we? Baby boomers all agree that their favorite castaway on Gilligan's Island was Marianne. That was the role famously played by Don Wells, and Don is on the line with us right now from California. Hi, Don.
Hello, hello.
Thanks for being on the program with us. I know you're very, very busy these days. You're doing so many things, which is why I want to start off by talking about a particular, well, bottom-feeding tabloid that need not be mentioned, but they recently put out an article about you being destitute, smoking pot, doing all kinds of things, losing your home. Where is this coming from?
I don't know, and it's fascinating to me. I was trying to talk to someone the other day. Do people get paid for just making things up? If I called up and said, boy, I just saw George Clooney naked running down the street, would somebody pay him $5,000 whether it was true or not? I don't know. It's fascinating. And it really hurts. I mean, it breaks your heart. I now can kind of separate myself from it because it's happened a couple of times, and I don't know. I guess the world focuses on gossip. There's a lot more people doing a lot worse things that they spend time with, Lindsay Lohan and all that. But I have spent a lot of my career kind of upholding the image of Marianne. And I think maybe there's something about trying to bring down the good girl. I don't know. It hurts for a while, but it's just laughable. I mean, they say that I've lost everything and I'm in an apartment and nobody knows where I am and my friends are all worried. And what? I sold my house. I bought a house years ago with a guest house so I could take care of my mom, and I lost my mother, so I don't need all of that at my age. It'd be nice to have somebody to repair the toilet and the plumbing, and I don't have to do it. And then it says I'm sitting around the pool smoking dope topless and don't want to work, and my friends are worried about me. I've had the busiest 18 months that I've had practically my whole life. So I guess people just, I don't know. I mean, you might tell me. What do you think the public's looking for? I find it fascinating, and yet it does hurt your feelings.
Well, you know, at least they're not linking you yet with the Kardashians.
Oh. Not yet. That's a different issue, though. I've got a book coming out. I think Marianne's morality is really important today. It's very hard to hang on to some of the things that we all grew up with, and the morality's kind of slipping away. And having something like that come out is almost like somebody slapped me in the face. But then again, I don't know how many people believe it or pay attention, or I don't know.
Well, let's go back a little bit and talk about the morality a little bit, because you were on a very successful show, you and your castmates, on Gilligan's Island back in the 60s, and I had a chance to speak several times with the late Bob Denver, especially around the time that his book came out several years ago. And I'm just wondering, with all the things that's going on today with Twitter and Facebook and the tabloids and the paparazzi, how much more difficult would your life have been had all this been going on when you were doing the show back in the 60s?
Well, I don't know. It's an interesting thing because I have never, I guess when Marianne went on the island, there was no birth control pill. So look at that. I mean, it was a whole different puritanical civilization because people were afraid to have babies, get pregnant. Then it was the riots in the colleges and the drugs started then, I think. I mean, I think it started back in the late 60s, not maybe, we were on 64 to 67. So just about 67, 68 is when it all started, the burning of the buildings and college and all of that. I mean, I don't know whether that was like prohibition years ago. I can't imagine having been tempted. I've been to many Hollywood parties. I have never been to a party where people were sniffing cocaine. I guess they wouldn't invite me. I was never chased around the desk of proposition as a casting couch. That didn't happen either. So maybe one or two incidents get blown out out of proportion. But right now there is so much. Freedom is not the right word. I don't know what to say. Maybe lack of self-discipline, lack of direction, lack of morality. I don't know what you'd say. Maybe people are just experimenting. I think the web and all that sort of stuff has opened things way too much. But when I'm writing a book, and I think one of the things in the world has changed, there's no mom and dad and four kids anymore. It's mom, stepmom, stepfather, surrogate kids that come and visit on the weekend because they're the ex-wife's child and all of that. Both parents have to work because things are so tough. I didn't get home from school till 4:00. They get home at 1:30. What do you do from 1:30 to 5 if you're a working mother? And what if you have a child that some other mother raised, but you have the child on weekends who has no manners, who sasses you, who swears? Can you discipline that 11-year-old that all of a sudden is your child? That's a very difficult time now. So I think the world has changed, and yet rules matter. Morality matters. I was watching, I don't know, not very long ago during pre-election, but Obama was on The View. And he didn't talk about his children. He doesn't like to talk about his children. And Barbara Walters said, well, just give us one rule or something, will you? And he said, okay, I'll tell you. Malia just got her phone. She's 14. She just got it. Sasha will not get her phone until she's 14. And neither girl talks on the phone except on weekends. Well, it's a rule. And I was raised with rules. If you can stick to the rules, if a little boy is taught to put his napkin on his lap when he's 2, I bet you by the time he's 20, it's automatic. It goes on his lap. So it isn't a constant conflict with your child. It's a constant just giving him a guideline, giving him something to measure up to. But I'm not so sure they all have the time.
Now, I mentioned in the introduction that you are busy. You said it's been the busiest 18 months for you. You've done 3 stage productions this year, Love Letters, Steel Magnolias, and Broadway in Love, Loss, and What I Wore.
Love, Loss, and What I Wore.
You've got 2 movies.
And you know what I'm doing in February?
You got 2 movies coming out.
I'm doing Lion in Winter. I'm doing the Katharine Hepburn role. I'm doing Eleanor, and I'm so excited. I can't stand it.
Excellent.
So I've been doing that. I've done 2 movies.
Right.
I have a reality show in development.
That's called Hunter.
I'm in the midst of writing a book.
That's called Hunter History, right?
Yeah. I think they want to say Hunt Our History now.
Okay.
But it's Hunter History. It's a scavenger hunt in cities you know nothing about.
And you have a book, you say, that's coming out, which I want to talk a little bit about because I love the title, Why We Love Marianne.
Why do we?
I mean, it's interesting because she really was, I really got the most fan mail. The boys and girls were both equally like her. She would have been your best friend, either male or female. And I really feel Marianne was the rudder. Marianne was the voice of reason. Marianne was the optimist. Marianne was the negotiator. Marianne was kind of the mother. The professor was kind of the dad, too. But when you really look at it, I mean, she kind of was the glue that kept everybody together. She made the Howells help. She felt so. And another thing that's a big issue, Gilligan could have been bullied. He did everything wrong all the time. We forgave him. We understood. You know, and I think Marianne was common sense. Common sense and I think optimistic. I think, and I don't know going into that if we knew that. And it's an interesting thing because I feel, after all these years of, in this business, if you're doing a series week after week after week after week and you're in someone's home, it's very different than a movie. Unless you're playing a witch like in Bewitched or something really outlandish, I think the person's character, the actor, the real person behind it shows through. And I think if you really and truly looked at the seven of us, we were pretty much those characters.
Well, I was about to
and
ask.
I was just thinking about this the other day. I'm not so sure I was sure was first choice because we were replacements. Ginger, Marianne, and the professor were replacements. And we had to read, and then we had to audition, and then we had to put it on tape and test. And after I met Sherwood two or three times, the final time, he said, she's too smart to play Marianne. I'll test her the second time around. And my agent said, no, test her now or don't test her. And I'm not so sure he started out with Marianne being, strong is not the right word, but being kind of the leader a little bit. I think he wanted more of the little Petticoat Junction, Beverly Hillbillies, Donna Douglas kind of character. And I think the character, me, Dawn, who I am, came through. And it made it, I think, a little more depth, maybe.
I always saw the character as being very optimistic without leaning toward Pollyannish.
And that's a hard thing to do, isn't it?
Yes.
Yeah. She's not goody two-shoes. No. She's not goody two-shoes. She just had good manners, good sense.
with the busy time period you've had over the last little while and the long career that you've had, is there anything you haven't done that you'd like to do?
Broadway.
Ah.
I've done off-Broadway, but I haven't done Broadway. And one of the things that thrills me so much is doing Eleanor, because it's very hard to get people to cast me in something that is so, I don't want to say totally opposite, but the strength. I think my age now has made a difference. Because I'm not bragging, but I'm a good actress. You may not know it from Marianne, but I've had a lot of stage. I went right back to the stage after Gilligan's Island to improve my craft. And I'm pretty good, but I had a hard time even getting an audition for Vagina Monologues. I've played Canada all over. I love your country. I've played it everywhere. I haven't been to Montreal, but I've played Vancouver and Toronto and Regina and Saskatchewan and Pretoria. I mean, I've played it all. I love your country. I don't think they're nearly as put you nearly in a specific kind of role. It took me an awful long time to say, I can do more than Marianne. I really can. But it took a long time to break that image, and going back to stage helped me.
Mm. Well, I'm glad to hear, not that I ever doubted, that you're doing well. I can't believe, and I haven't bothered to mention the name of the tabloid, and I don't see the need to, but I'm glad to hear that everything's working out, and you're busy, and you're working, and you've got a lot of projects coming up. We'll look forward to the new reality show, which tentatively is called Hunter History. The title may change, and we'll also look forward to your book, Why We Love Marianne, and perhaps maybe when that book is out, we'll have you back on the program if you're available.
Oh, I'd love to do that, and I'd love to talk to you again. Thank you so much for having me. It's a great opportunity, and our countries are so close together, you know.
Thanks for being on.
You got to entertain me in Montreal, though. I really want to come and see your city. I do.
Absolutely. That's actress Dawn Wells. Every bit as fun and effervescent as her character Marianne was from Gilligan's Island. You can keep up with all the things that she's doing by going to her website at dawn-wells or dawn-wells.com. And you can go to my website at thestufffile.com, go to the What's On page for this show, which is show number 0172, and you'll find links to her site.
You're listening to The Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. Drop Peter a line. He'd love to hear from you. You can email him at peter@thestufffile.com or catch up with him on Twitter or Facebook. There's more Stuff File coming your way in just a few moments.
Kelly Alexander Show is your place to be for everything to do with health, lifestyle, and entertainment. Join us as we chat with celebrities like Emmy winner Mia Michaels from So You Think You Can Dance, best-selling recording artist Taylor Dane, and world-renowned astronaut Julie Payette. We also cover important topics like breast cancer awareness and how to help your child through bullying. All this and more, please join us, www.kellyalexandershow.com.
It's the Kelly Alexander Show.
Capture your need for sound.
Peter Anthony Holder here. Have you ever noticed on some of those public broadcasting pledge drives, they tend to sound like ransom demands in a kidnapping?
Hey, your kids like this, Mr. Rogers. It would be most unfortune if, for some unforeseen reason, you weren't in the neighborhood no more.
Well, I'm here to ask for your support in a non-threatening, non-obligatory kind of way. Part of the success of the Stuff File depends on the generosity of its listeners worldwide. So if you can, and if you want, please feel free to make a small one-time donation. Just go to the website at thestufffile.com and click on the PayPal donation button. You can donate $10, $5, or even $1, whatever you'd like.
You know that big bird? That would be one huge drumstick, if you know what I mean.
If you have a PayPal account, it's an easy transfer. And if you don't, all major credit cards are accepted. Your generosity would be much appreciated in keeping this show running.
About that antique roadshow, they might be seeing a little more concrete than they originally anticipated.
No strong-arm tactics, no ransom demands. Just a simple please and thank you. To donate, visit thestufffile.com.
You're listening to the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. It's radio for now and forever, unless the Mayans were right.
And still to come on the program, we'll talk to the author of Second Chance about post-traumatic stress disorder, and we'll also talk to the author of The Specific Density of Scientists, which deals a little bit with cult behavior. And of course, there is indeed an idiot of the day and lots more stuff for you right here, right now, on a program that's heard on Stitcher Smart Radio, the smarter way to listen to radio. No do-overs. By 2009, James Washington believed he had gotten away with a 1995 murder, but then he had a heart attack. And on his deathbed, in a fit of remorse, he confessed to a confidant. "I have to get something off my conscience," he told a guard in the jailhouse where he was serving time for a lesser unrelated offense. However, Washington miraculously recovered from the heart attack and tried to take back his confession, but prosecutors in Nashville, Tennessee were unfazed. They used it to augment the sparse evidence from 1995, and in October of 2012, the now healthier Washington was convicted of the murder and sentenced to 51 more years in prison. Oopsie. And when a Chinese restaurant delivery driver in West Hartford, Connecticut, stopped to make a delivery, someone jumped into his car and took off. The thief wasn't so much after the food. He made the next delivery so he could pocket the money. Police simply staked out the two remaining addresses on the route, and when Keith Hines, age 45, pulled up at one to make a delivery, officers arrested him on theft charges as well as drug possession. You know, it's not a good plan to sell off the food just before you kind of get the munchies. I was seriously considering making this guy the idiot of the day on this week's show, but I did not. That, however, comes later. Now, when April Wilson came out of her Roanoke Rapids, North Carolina home, she said, "I happened to look at the curb and I was like, something's missing." Her boyfriend's motorcycle was gone, but not stolen. Neighbors said the city's garbage collectors took it. Her boyfriend, Joseph Morning, went to the trash facility and found it. "I just looked at it and shook my head and just walked away," Morning said. "I just couldn't believe it, that it was my bike torn all to pieces like that." The city refused to pay for the damage, saying Morning should contact his own insurance company. He contacted the media instead and embarrassed city officials, then asked their own insurance company to take care of it. Now, you know, that's what you call thinking outside the box, and nice use of the media, too, when you're at it. Also, that's one idiot of a garbage collector, and it's also interesting how the bureaucrats wanted to cover their tracks, not taking responsibility and tell the guy his own insurance company had to deal with it. Yeah, nice going, pal. Apparently you can fight City Hall, or at least you can embarrass them. Anyway, for months, Valerie Hernandez, age 33, thought someone was living in the attic of her Carlsbad, New Mexico home. A police investigation found nothing, but she said she felt like someone was constantly watching her and had bugged her house. Then the house burned down. According to investigators, Hernandez said she had gone to the store to buy a soda at the time of the fire. But when police checked her story, they discovered she had bought lighter fluid at the store that night, not soda. She also repeatedly asked police if the body of the supposed intruder was found in the ashes of her home. No body was found. Hernandez, by the way, is now awaiting trial for arson. You know, there may not have been a man in her attic, but there are certainly bats in her belfry. Police found Sheila Hubank, age 48, tied up in her vehicle in a field in San Antonio, Texas, as she told them that she was at a drive-through ATM when a man jumped into her vehicle and forced her at knife point to drive around making what she believed to be drug deals. She said the man then tied her up and left her in a field. But police discovered a lottery ticket in her purse, time-stamped, during the period she claimed she was being forced to drive around. When confronted with a store security camera video of her buying the ticket, healthy, pleasant, and alone, she recanted her story, saying she claimed kidnapped because, quote, she simply wanted a day off from work and wanted attention. Eubank was arrested and charged with aggravated perjury and third-degree felony. Bail was set at $10,000. Well, several days off work and a lot of media attention. Sounds like she got what she wanted. Yeah. And finally, in this section of Stuff File News, before we get to our next guest here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, he stood up and then he walked out, said Constable Pat Brooks of the Toronto Police. It sounds so simple, doesn't it? He says Jacob Allen Mann, age 24, was in court to face charges of forcible confinement, assault, and violating parole. When the prisoner next to him was told he could leave, Mann got up instead and just simply walked out. Mann, who is considered dangerous, wasn't caught for 6 days. For something this easy, Brooks said, I haven't heard of that in the past. Yeah, well, but now that everyone knows how easy it is, I'm sure you'll hear of a similar case like this very soon. Anyway, let's get to our next guest here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. Dr. Stephen Weiss is a decorated World War II veteran who has written a book that recounts his military journey. It's called Second Chance, and Dr. Weiss is on the line with us right now from the UK. Hello, sir.
Hello.
You've written this book, and it's 70 years after the war. Why wait till now to do this book?
I had to grow into it. I had to consider the issues, consider the experiences, and then to have some kind of understanding of why I went through it and how did I succeed and fail with regard to the experience.
You talk about PTSD, or post-traumatic stress disorder, which back in the day was simply called shell shock. And this was something that you had to deal with yourself, correct?
Well, that's right. Shell shock was an outcome of the experiences in the trenches in World War I. My experiences in Europe and World War II had a different connotation, a different name. It was called either combat fatigue or combat exhaustion.
Right. So how did you deal with it?
Well, with great difficulty. The reason being that it was never talked about. It was never interpreted or defined. And up on the front, it was something that we all experienced over time. but we had no clues as to what it all meant, although our behavior increasingly became more bizarre.
We tend to forget that in a time of going to battle are also very young. How old were you at the time?
18.
And you went, you landed at the beaches of southern France back in 1944. You actually became separated, you and some others got separated from your company, did you not?
Yes, we did. And it was the outcome of the night attack.
So
we were trying to contribute to the elimination of the German 19th Army that was trying to extract itself from southern and southeastern France to get to the German-Franco border. And they fought with great intensity.
In putting together this book, admittedly, like you say, it's 70 years later, did you have an opportunity at all to get in contact with people who, other survivors who may have been going through the same thing, either near you or with you at the time of war?
Yes, I did. And the results weren't particularly good, because there was no real understanding of the problems. There was no good method of therapy at the time. And so the returning soldiers, the combat soldiers, really suffered a great deal, not knowing how to solve the problems. And so most of us were dysfunctional in our return to civilian life. And a lot of people close to us suffered.
Well, let's talk a little bit about civilian life, because I introduced you as Dr. Stephen Weiss. So what was your civilian life like after coming out of the war?
I spent a year in Paris as a photographer for the U.S. Army and then for the American government. But I began to realize that something was amiss. Even though I had experienced certain manifestations of combat fatigue, there was no definition of post-traumatic stress in those days. It wasn't even used. That came out of the Vietnamese War. But the symptoms were very severe in terms of nightmares, and also unpredictably, I would suffer a severe haze in front of my eyes that would come upon me without any kind of rhyme or reason, but it certainly stopped me in my tracks, and it increased whatever level of abnormal anxiety I had, because I never knew when I would have another attack.
And now, later in life, and by the way, you also, you mentioned your work as a photographer. You also worked with Edward R. Murrow for about 10 years, did you not?
Yes, I did, in Hollywood. I was working for CBS Television, and he was doing a program called Person to Person. And any of the stars who were living on the West Coast, living in Hollywood, we would have a live program, he in New York for the most of the time, and I and the people he wanted to interview, like Humphrey Bogart, Lauren Bacall, Fred Astaire, Ginger Rogers, they essentially were living and making films on the West Coast.
Now, as I said, you are a doctor. You have a master's and a doctorate in war studies from King's College in London, and a master's degree in clinical psychology, which you attained. You got your PhD when you were 76 years old. I understand that you now work with combat soldiers suffering from PTSD. What's it like doing that kind of work for you, especially someone who has been through it yourself?
Well, I spent 23 years in private practice as a clinical psychologist in Los Angeles and Beverly Hills, and that certainly set me up, or prepared me, I should say, for any kind of treatment, either the outcomes of difficulties in civilian life as civilians, or for soldiers who were still experiencing
post-traumatic stress quite a few years after the original attacks, when they were younger men or adolescent boys.
Now,
I was well prepared.
Yeah, your book, Second Chance, tells the story of young soldiers' experience during the war. And I understand that Steven Spielberg has first options of the rights of turning your story into a film.
Well, not necessarily. I mean, he does have a copy of it, but we've never been in contact. We did meet in Normandy one time when we were interviewed. I preceded him, and then he followed. But he does have a copy, but there's no arrangement between us with regard for first options for him.
I'm assuming, though, you would like to see this story turned into a film.
I certainly would. I just completed a tour of the United States visiting four major cities. I was interviewed on radio and television. I enjoy giving talks. I think you can sense that. And what I do is to give back to society in my lectures, certainly at King's and in other universities throughout Europe, sometimes in the United States, to let young men know how difficult fighting on the front line is, and that the outcome, regardless of the war, is in a very short time, young men are either killed, wounded, or missing. And in my night attack, my experience, I ended up missing for over 2 months with the major help of the French resistance and serving then afterwards with them behind the German lines. And then finally, before I was able to get to my division, the 36th Texas Division, I fought with a combat unit of the OSS, the Office of Strategic Services, which was a paramilitary group that fought behind German lines and tried to do as most damage as possible.
In your work with soldiers who suffer from PTSD, having been through battle fatigue yourself, is your work with these soldiers in itself a healing process for you as well?
Certainly, overall, I would say so, but I worked through my healing process a number of years earlier. It all began in 1947 when, having returned to the United States and left New York to live in Los Angeles, I reached a point, a very low point, where I would either kill myself or do something about it. And fortunately, the outcome is such that we're talking here today. But the severity of it, the symptoms of it, the understanding that I'm understanding of it, no one knew what was going on. I didn't. My parents didn't. Doctors really didn't. There was only one psychotherapy available, and that was psychoanalysis, and that didn't work for everybody. And so therefore, considering I really was in desperate circumstances, and fortunately, I worked my way out. The benefit for the people I treated, I was old enough and I experienced exactly what they were going through when they came to me as patients.
It's a fascinating story. The book is called Second Chance. It's by Dr. Stephen J. Weiss. And Stephen, I thank you very, very much for sharing your story with us and talking about the book.
It's my pleasure, and thank you very much for having me.
Dr. Stephen Weiss, author of Second Chance. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com, go to the What's On page for this show, which is show number 0172, and you'll find links to Amazon.com and Amazon.ca, where you can order his book directly. You're listening to The Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
I'm Bob DiRigo-Jones, and this is Let's Be Fair. Over the years, we've talked about many reasons for not filing a lawsuit. They can be expensive and time-consuming, of course, but did you know that one reason actually has a special name featured on Wikipedia? It's called the Streisand Effect. The name comes from a lawsuit filed by entertainer Barbara Streisand. Here's the story. Several years ago, Streisand sued a photographer for $50 million. She didn't like a picture the photographer had taken of her home as part of a government effort to document erosion of the California coastline. Before her lawsuit, only 6 people had downloaded the picture from the internet. But after she sued, more than 400,000 people visited the website and then saw her home. Let's be fair, making a mountain out of a molehill by filing a lawsuit can backfire in many ways, and celebrities aren't the only ones affected. Next week, I'll tell you about a small business that learned this the hard way. Find out more about the hidden costs of lawsuit abuse. Visit our website at centerforamerica.org.
You're listening to The Stuff File, now with 25% fewer calories. Here's Peter Anthony Holder.
And still to come in the program, we'll talk about cult behavior. Plus, we will indeed have an idiot of the day, but right now, more Stuff File news. Here on a program that you can hear on Stitcher Smart Radio. You know, Stitcher allows you to listen to your favorite shows directly on your iPhone, Android phone, Kindle Fire, and beyond, basically any mobile device that you might have. It's on demand and on the go, and you don't have Stitcher yet? Well, what are you waiting for? Download it. It's free. You can get it at Stitcher.com or in the app stores. Again, it's absolutely free, and you'll find, including the Stuff File program, over 10,000 shows that you can listen to. So there you go. Stitcher Smart Radio, it's the smarter way to listen to radio. Well, back to the Stuff File news. An Iowa jewelry store is offering free hunting rifles to customers who purchase engagement rings before the end of October. Yeah, that sounds like an interesting promotion. The Jewelry by Harold store in North Liberty has the Buy Her a Diamond and Receive a Free Hunting Rifle promotion. Fun is more important than anything else. We try to put some fun in it, said store owner Harold Van Beek. Hunting season is coming up. I thought this is cool, so let's do something for the boy who doesn't like to hunt for diamonds but likes to hunt for deer. Van Beek said customers who buy diamond engagement rings costing $1,999 or more prior to the end of October, which is now a couple of months ago, would have received vouchers for free Remington 870 hunting rifles at Finn and Feather in Iowa City. Diamonds are a girl's best friend, Van Beek said. So, say I'm hunting deer, and here's a diamond ring, dear. Wow. Yeah. Anybody out there see a problem with this? Anyone? Anyone? Bueller? Yeah. Let's get to our next guest here on the Stuff File program, shall we? David Kahn is an investigator and an expert in the political ramifications of cult behavior. He is the author of The Specific Density of Scientists and Their Secret Fears, and David joins us on the line from California. Hi, David.
Hi. Good to be aboard.
Thanks for being on the program with us. The situation with cults. First of all, I want to talk about your book and the title. What exactly does it mean, The Specific Density of Scientists?
Well, it's a little takeoff, of course. Specific density is a scientific term, but it also relates to what I think is a major failure in the thinking of many scientists. And so I go into that very deeply in the book, and I deal with two major points and a third very important point. And it stems from Lord Bertrand Russell's truism, which says, and it's proved mathematically, it's just undeniable, that either all religions are wrong or only one is right. And that's just absolutely infallible. And so from there, I realized that many scientists then, they attempt by scientific means to disprove God. When they make the mistake, and I attribute that to what I call scientism, which is a form of science cultic thinking, because they will not stay within the bounds of their paradigm, which is to investigate, observe, and show evidence of everything that goes on in the natural universe. But when they step outside that, they are actually stepping outside the scientific bounds, and then they begin to get into philosophy, and at that point, they miss another major important point, and that is what I call Lednorf's dilemma. And that is, very simply, that if you premise an almighty and perfectly fair God, would that God give you, a scientist with your majestic brain, would that God give you an advantage over others to his kingdom? And that's a very simple question, and every time I put that to a scientist, he realizes that he's done for, because he understands logic. If he understands nothing else, he understands logic, and he knows that perfectly fair cannot contain unfairness.
Okay, so let's...
And that's a major, major mistake.
Okay, so let's deal a little bit with cults, and I want to know, what, in your estimation, what the difference is, what the line is, between a cult mentality or just a positive group?
Well, in the first place, one of the major signs of a cult mentality is the inability to see the obvious. And that happens all over the place. And a cult mentality, the difference between a cult mentality and cults in themselves is simply organizational. And it stems from some cult leader organizing and premising certain precepts according to his own cultic views. And he furthers that by certain brainwashing techniques. And it's irrational thinking because it serves a purpose. And then when he gets into it, then he maintains that cult by way of fear. Even in some cults, they make their cult tired from overstress and all that, and begins then to cause the mind to kind of refashion itself because of tiredness and lack of food and all that.
So are you saying then that someone can have cult behavior and yet not be in a cult?
Yes, because everyone, to one degree or another, fails to think deeply and courageously and honestly. In every case, that is a basic fact in a cult. But it's also that kind of thinking that allows people to enter cults, because they are not able to have a good frame of reference to discern when they're being brainwashed or when somebody is highly narcissistic or charismatic and establishes a cult. And then the people who are, to some degree, very insecure, either from upbringing or bad parents or what all, then they fall to the thinking of a cult leader who is really in it for self-serving. And it almost always invariably means a charismatic person, because they're the only ones that can accomplish that and sway people.
Well, let me ask you this, because recently in the United States, you just went through a very, very long political campaign. And the one thing you hear a lot of these days is the lack of bipartisan thinking. And there was a lot of sniping and a lot of anger on both sides of the political spectrum. Would you say there is cult behavior in politics?
Oh, yes. Yeah, there certainly is. You see it all over the place, because the politician, whenever he gets off into using certain devices and misleading tactics and all, that's all a sign of a cult personality. When I finished doing my investigation of the Jim Jones thing, I failed to warn the media that Congressman Ryan would. I warned one media that Congressman Ryan would not come out of South America alive, and of course, that happened, and he was murdered, and hundreds of others. But I then started a deep investigation into the whole political system in California, trying to determine what it was that caused people to fail to see the obvious signs of this cult leader, Jim Jones. And I saw all sorts of signs then, and deception is a key sign, of course. When all those politicians would not admit their mistake, and because they simply lied. They said they didn't know how bad he was. And I had already worked with a journalist 7 years, 8 years before the mass murder. And that journalist wrote 8 articles. That was Lester Kinsolving with the San Francisco Examiner. I met with him 3 years into my investigation. And he wrote 8 articles. And when he published 4 of them, Jones found out about it and brought hundreds of his cult down from Ukiah, surrounded the San Francisco Examiner, and he threatened lawsuits and all that. The Examiner didn't have that much money. And so they backed off and they pulled the final 4 articles. But my point is, all those politicians, and that includes Governor Brown, who's now our present governor, by the way, he was a buddy of Jim Jones and even spoke from Jones's temple cult, and along with others. It's just astounding. And the mayor and Willie Brown, a major political figure in the country, also was an instrument that was primarily responsible for Jones getting that power position that he had finally attained. And it's just stunning to see how they all later, when it all came down, lied and said they had nothing to do with it. They, every one of them, knew very well that they could have gone to the Examiner and read all 8 of those articles.
Well, let me ask you this.
Very clear.
Let me ask you this, because we're just about out of time. How does one... Or how do you go about stopping cult-type thinking?
Well, for one, a major thing is to try to get people to think deeply and courageously and honestly, and not serve themselves, but to serve truth, to serve real information. And if that happens, and people get that kind of courage, and I think that it can only happen when they tie into some basic frame of reference that is tied simply to truth and not to manipulate people. And if they do that, they will then free themselves. But they have to give themselves over to truth and the search for truth and put aside anything that serves the self. If they can do that, they will become free.
It sounds like that could be easier said than done when a lot of people are, let's be honest, followers in one shape or form or another.
Yes, that's true. And in my book, The Specific Density of Scientists, I do put in there a background in the appendix of everything I went through and what I tried to find out. And that whole behind the scenes story is the only instance where people can see everything that went on that did not come out to the public. The public doesn't know Willie Brown and the role he played in getting Jones into that high position, for example. That behind the scenes story is fascinating. It's also in another book by Ben Barrick called Unsung Davids. He's the only journalist that published that entire behind-the-scenes story that I went through, and it's really well worth reading. It's Unsung Davids by Ben Barrick.
And people
and
can...
I urge people to read that.
And people can find out more information by reading your book, The Specific Density of Scientists and Their Secret Fears, and they can also check out your website with it, which is truthsleuth.net. David, I thank you very, very much for taking the time to be on the program with us.
Yes, and thank you very much.
David Kahn, author of The Specific Density of Scientists and Their Secret Fears. You can check out his website at truthsleuth.net, and you can go to my website at thestufffile.com, go to the What's On page for this show, which is show number 0172, and you'll find links to his site. You'll also find links to amazon.com and amazon.ca, where you can order his book directly. You're listening to The Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. Time now for The Idiot of the Day.
And now it's time for The Strange Things Adults Do. The Stuff File presents The Idiot of the Day.
Police say a man involved in the theft of several items from a Castle jewelry store in Pikeville, Kentucky, was caught after trying to sell some of the items to a Castle store in Lexington. Castle Regional Manager Matt Will said that Seth Scott came into the store Friday night trying to sell distinctive gold chains, and employees called police. When officers arrived, they said they found almost $20,000 worth of merchandise in Scott's vehicle. Police said he is facing several charges, including receiving stolen property and possession of burglary tools. Will said Scott's judgment didn't seem to be, quote, working properly. Why would someone steal a jewelry store chain's distinctive gold chains and then try to sell them to another store in the same chain nearby? One reason, and one reason only: he's an idiot!
Gee, I'm only a kid, but even I know you're an idiot.
And that's it for this edition of the Stuff File program number 0172. Hope you enjoyed it. The website is thestufffile.com. And once again, stuff is spelled S-T-U-P-H, where you'll find information and links on all of our guests by going to the weekly Stuff File page. Just look for the corresponding program number. And again, that's 0172. Email me at peter@thestufffile.com. You could also find me on Facebook and Twitter as P.A. Holder. And don't forget to check out the Stuff File store, where you can purchase a plethora of Stuff File merchandise, from t-shirts to mugs to tote bags to mouse pads. Hope to see you back here for our next show on the air, online, or as a download. We're coming to you from everywhere, including CyberStationUSA.com, KDXRadio.com, AirChecker, Canada's number one radio source, streaming on PCJ Media and its partner stations, TrueTalkRadio.com, downloaded on iTunes and Stitcher, and over the air on World FM in New Zealand, MediaCorp in Singapore, and WSTJ in St. Johnsbury, Vermont. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, a presentation of Flying Fish Communications. Guests of the Stuff File program stay at their own homes.
Trust me, I'm the voice for this program. I know there's no budget for accommodations. I'm reading this on a futon.